The book of Joshua in chapter 1 tells us that after the death of Moses, the Lord spoke to Joshua, who would become the next leader of his people. And he told him, beginning in verse 2 of Joshua 1, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites into the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." About 40 years earlier, this same man, Joshua, was one of the spies who had been sent into the land of Canaan. 10 of those spies came back and they were afraid. They were afraid of the people that they'd seen in the land. They were afraid that they couldn't stand against them. They were afraid that they and their children would be destroyed. And because of their lack of faith, Israel was required to wander in the wilderness. A whole generation died. The generation that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness. But along with Caleb, Joshua was one of the two spies who said, "We can do this." And now it is that same Joshua who stands along with Israel, poised on the eastern bank of the Jordan River, ready to cross the river and to conquer this land which God had promised to his ancestors. The Lord commanded Joshua three times in this text, "Be strong and of good courage," or some language very similar to that. Three times he encourages this new leader of his people. And he also provided in his comments, the Lord did, the basis for such courage. "For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go," verse 5 and verse 9. He says the similar things. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 1 states, "To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven." I believe that principle doesn't have universal application. There's a time to sin and a time not to sin. That wouldn't work if we understand the rest of the Bible. But I believe it is a valid principle in many ways for many things that that we face in life. And it is certainly true that there's a time to fear and there's a time not to fear. There's a time to fear, there's a time to flee, and there's a time to be brave, to be courageous. The Lord knew that Joshua and the people who followed him were facing a task that was daunting to them. And so he encouraged them to be courageous. I want to talk this morning about the need that we have as Christians to be courageous. I think there is a proper role for fear in our lives. And about a year ago, or a little less than a year ago, I talked about the motivation of fear and the purposes, positive and negative, that fear serves in the lives of people. This morning, I want to talk about the courage that's necessary to be a successful disciple. And I want to help each of one of us to be encouraged as we look at the Scriptures in this regard. The word fear can refer to a reverential awe. We sometimes talk about fearing God, and what we mean is that we have a respect for God. We hold Him in awe or in reverence, and that's not really the fear that I'm talking about this morning, because fear can also refer to, as Webster suggests, a painful emotion marked by alarm, dread, disquiet. All of us have experienced that. Something happens perhaps very quickly and it startles us and it almost galvanizes our body. We feel the physical response. Or perhaps our minds begin to work on us and create or suggest dangers that might lie around the corner or in the darkness or whatever, and we find that disquieting. We dread those things. That's the fear I'm talking about. I'm talking about that painful emotion. And the Bible suggests that there's a time to fear. There are some legitimate objects of our fear. For instance, we are told in Matthew the 10th chapter by the Lord Himself, as He's sending out His disciples, that they should not fear the ones who might persecute them as they would go out and preach the message of the kingdom. There's nothing covered that will not be revealed and hidden that will not be known. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. And that's all that man can do to you. That's all that he can do to me. That's the worst that he can do, is to kill the body. But the Lord continued and said, but rather fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And I don't think we're talking about reverential fear here. I think we're talking about another kind of fear. We need to legitimately fear the prospect of having both soul and body destroyed in hell. We ought to be afraid to disobey God. And there were numerous laws, regulations in the Old Testament that were designed for that very purpose, was to make people afraid of the consequences of breaking the law or disobeying God. This is one of my favorites. I don't know how you teenagers feel about this, but in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 18 through 21, the law said that if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of the city, and they shall say to the elders of this city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. Now, I don't think that every parent who had a child who disobeyed them hauled them out to the elders of the city and said, our son is stubborn and rebellious. But the law provided for a situation in which parents would take their child and say to the elders of the city, this child will not mind. He's rebellious. He's a glutton, a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Wow. You stone them. Disobedient child. No young person should ever think that disobeying parents is an unimportant thing. Because God said there are circumstances under which you take a disobedient child and you take them out and you stone them. And everybody will hear it and fear. And I'm just using this as an example. We could multiply other regulations in which the same comment is made. Do this, don't pity them, and people will see it and they'll fear. Fear what? Fear to disobey God. Fear the breaking of the law and its consequences. We see that in the New Testament with a couple of early Christians, Ananias and Sapphira. You know the story, I'll not belabor the details, but in Acts chapter 5, they lied to the apostles. In essence, they lied to the Holy Spirit, to God. And when accosted by Peter, Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and breathed his last. So great fear came upon all those who heard these things. I'll bet it did. Do you think anybody else quickly lied about anything to the apostles? Here lies Ananias. He lied, he died. Verse 11, a little later on, his wife Sapphira came in, and the same thing happened to her, and they carried her out. And his wife, Sapphira. So great fear came upon all the church and upon all who heard these things. And again, I think what's happening here is people are afraid to disobey God because of the consequences. And I think that's a legitimate fear. I think we ought to be afraid. In fact, the Apostle Paul, writing to the young evangelist Timothy, had these things to say in chapter 5 of 1 Timothy. In that context, at least earlier in the chapter, earlier, a few verses earlier, he has been talking about elders and those who rule well or supervise well the flock. And I really believe that verse 20 is probably talking about elders, but here's the principle. Those who are sinning, Paul tells Timothy, rebuke in the presence of all that the rest also may fear. What's to be the consequence of this rebuke? In front of everyone, so that others will fear to do the same thing. In Romans, the 11th chapter, there is an extended illustration used by the Apostle Paul in which he talks about God's grace or His favor as being like a tree and Israelites being branches on this tree, the natural branches. But because of their unbelief, they were broken off and grafted in. Instead were Gentiles. He's talking about Christians. But Paul says, in response to any Gentile Christian might say, well, they were broken off and we were grafted in. Well said, because of unbelief they were broken off. And you stand by faith. Don't be arrogant. Fear. Why? Because the same thing could happen to you that happened to them. If you are guilty of unbelief, God will break your branch off also, even as He did these Jewish people who were His chosen people under the Old Testament covenant. And so there's a time to fear. And yet, the other side of that coin is that the Scriptures give many indications that God wants His disciples to be courageous individuals. I think there's evidence that Timothy may have been a little bit timid. If you go to 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, as Paul concludes that epistle, he mentions Timothy, and he says in 1 Timothy 16 and verse 10, "And if Timothy comes, see that he may be with you without fear, for he does the work of the Lord as I also do." Now, suppose you could look at that verse and say, well, maybe the Corinthians were just really rough people. It wasn't so much Timothy as it was the Corinthians. But when I read Paul's second epistle to Timothy, 2 Timothy, the first chapter, there are several things said in that chapter that make me think that perhaps Timothy was becoming afraid of standing forth for the gospel, that he may have been a little timid in some circumstances. Verse 7 is really kind of a representative verse. You could go through chapter 1 and notice two or three occasions where Paul makes the observation that Timothy didn't need to be ashamed, not of Paul, not of the gospel. Why would Paul say these things? But he says to Timothy, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." He says that in response to, or I should say as a consequence of the command he gave in verse 6. "Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands." Why, Timothy? Or why, Paul? He says, because God hasn't given us a spirit of fear. Don't hold that in. But rather He has given us a spirit of power and of love and of a sound mind. But at the same time that the Apostle Paul admonished Timothy not to be afraid, that we haven't been given a spirit of fear, I believe the Apostle Paul on occasion was afraid. There are a couple of cases in the Scriptures in Acts chapter 18, when Paul was at Corinth. He was evidently suffering a good bit of persecution and controversy. And the Lord speaks to Paul and says, "Don't be afraid, speak out. I have a lot of people in this city." And the Lord does the same thing in Acts chapter 27, verse 24, encourages Paul not to be afraid. I think the reason for those encouragements was because he was lacking some courage, perhaps, or perhaps had some fears of what might happen to him. So even the Apostle Paul needed to be reminded from time to time and encouraged to be brave as a disciple of Jesus Christ. Paul himself reminded the Romans in his letter to them in chapter 8 that we have been given a spirit of adoption, not a spirit of bondage, again to fear, he says. And I understand what Paul to be saying is this, that the individual who was living under the old law, he lived with a spirit of a bondage. And that bondage produced fear because he couldn't escape the consequences of his sin. Not ultimately, he could offer an animal sacrifice, but he couldn't be made righteous through his own merit. And so the law became an instrument of bondage and death to him, and that, of course, would produce fear. In the book of Revelation that we've been studying in the adult class here in the auditorium, in the letter to the church at Smyrna, the Lord himself said in chapter 2 and verse 10, "Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer." Now, listen to what is said again. The Lord didn't say, "Don't be afraid if you suffer." The Lord said, "You're going to suffer. Don't be afraid of the things that are coming." He said the same thing essentially later on in the same book in chapter 21 and verse 8. He made the observation that those who are cowardly or the fearful, they don't belong with God's people. I want to suggest to you that the life of a Christian requires courage for a number of reasons. And I'll list just a few that have occurred to me. It takes courage to do the right thing, especially when the cost of righteousness is high. And you probably can think of some examples or illustrations of that, maybe in your own life or in the lives of others of whom you are aware, but I'll tell you that sometimes friendships are destroyed because a Christian has a conviction about something, and so people who used to be wonderful friends maybe for a long time go separate ways. You ever had that problem? I have. I've lost friends because I couldn't go where they wanted to go. I couldn't do what they wanted to do because I knew it was wrong. And that'll cost you, and it hurts sometimes to lose friends, close friends. Even jobs are sometimes lost by Christians because they won't sacrifice their integrity. They won't lie to make a buck. They won't deceive people in order to make a profit. It takes courage to do the right thing. Now, I know there are times when there's not a big cost to doing the right thing. Nobody's standing there waiting to beat you if you do the right thing. But understand, there will be occasions, there will be many occasions if you live long enough, in which you will pay the cost for doing what's right. And I just got to be frank with you, there are people who don't have the courage to do that. And so they buckle under the pressure and they just kind of run with the herd and do what everybody else is doing. The church in America is full of those kind of people who compromise their convictions when it costs them to do the right thing. It takes courage to present the gospel to those who may not be receptive. You ever done that? You ever had the opportunity to speak to somebody and you kind of held back because you weren't sure just how they would take it? Or the time wasn't quite right? I've done that. I think it takes courage to present the gospel without knowing what people are going to say or how they're going to react. Sometimes you're pretty sure they're not going to react very well based on your knowledge of their life or even what little contact you might have had with them. In John the 7th chapter, there's an interesting statement there. Jesus had been doing miracles and there were people talking everywhere, but they wouldn't talk openly for fear of the Jews, verse 13 says of John 7. Why was that? Because they were afraid of the consequences. They were afraid that by talking openly that they might be grouped with Jesus and someone might throw them out of the synagogue or in some other way persecute them. In the 19th chapter, the man who came to Pilate and asked for the body of our Lord is described as a secret disciple because of fear of the Jews. Now, I understand there were times in the history of the church when people met secretly. They didn't openly do this or do that in service of the Lord because it could cost them their lives. We need to be careful that we're not quiet about who we are or what we believe because of what somebody else might say. It takes courage to do evangelism. It takes courage to withstand the scoffing and criticism of unbelievers. Most of us have had friends who've made fun of us because they view us as kind of right-wing nuts. That's becoming more and more common in our culture, our society, as people tend to move in their religious and political beliefs more to the left, as we call it, to more liberal type viewpoints. And you may end up being shunned by people that you would like to spend time with. You may be ostracized among a group of people that you would really like to be included. Maybe at work, nobody wants to spend a lot of time with you because they know you're a Christian and they're not going to be doing the things that you will do. They want to do other things. Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 11, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake." Blessed are you, but it takes courage to withstand that kind of treatment. When people will just say the meanest, nastiest, untrue things about you to hurt you, because in a sense your life is basically a rebuke of their lives. It takes courage to continue to do the right thing. It takes courage to correct those who are sinning or to stand up for truth. Been in that circumstance where you needed to say something and you didn't say it because you didn't want to make somebody upset? It takes courage to say to somebody what you did was wrong. It takes even more courage sometimes to say it to brethren, but sometimes that has to be done. Christianity's not for cowards. You can't be a good Christian, you can't be a successful disciple if you're afraid to do what the Lord requires you to do. It takes courage to admit our own sins and to accept the consequences of our actions. That's the reason sometimes people don't confess sin. They won't acknowledge sin. They'll try to excuse themselves because they know what the consequences are. And they're afraid of those consequences. You know, it's a truism. Don't sin, you don't have to worry about that. But all of us sin from time to time. It takes courage to say, "I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have treated you that way. I shouldn't have said that to you." It takes courage. Not everybody has that courage. Well, how do we strengthen our courage? How do we gain that kind of courage so that we can live lives acceptable before God? I would say to you that perhaps part of the answer is to recognize the cause of our fears. And that's why I asked for Matthew 14 to be read. In that story of Jesus walking on the water to his disciples, one of the disciples gets out of the boat. Can you imagine what it would take for you to get out of the boat and to walk? Peter had lived around the Sea of Galilee probably all of his life. I don't know if he'd seen people drown before, but I'm sure he knew what it was about. This is a storm, in the midst of a storm. And he gets out of the boat and he's walking on the water. That doesn't happen every day. But then he gets distracted by the wind and the waves. And he begins to sink. And what I want you to notice is that Jesus' question in verse 31 indicated that his fear was connected to a lack of faith. Jesus did not ask, "Why did you become afraid?" He said, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And Jesus made a clear connection between Peter's fear and a lack of faith. And I'm not suggesting to you that that's necessarily the cause of all fears, but I think it is frequently the cause of fear. When Peter began to sink, what did the Lord do? He reached out. Immediately, the text said, I paid attention to the reading, and it said, immediately he reached out and he took Peter, and Peter was fine. I will tell you, I don't think Peter was ever in any danger. I don't think the Lord had any intention of allowing Peter to drown in the Sea of Galilee. But Peter had to believe that. And the reason he began to sink is because he stopped thinking about trusting in God and he started looking at the waves. And I would suggest to you that we need to build a strong faith in the promises of God. If you haven't turned to Hebrews, the 13th chapter, listen to the words of the Hebrew writer here in verse 5. He says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." Why should you have to worry about physical things? God's going to take care of you. That's his promise. "So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is my helper. I will not fear." That's the point that the Lord was trying to get across to Peter. I think sometimes we're afraid of things we don't understand. There's an amazing story in Luke, the 8th chapter. It's the story of Jesus crossing the Sea of Galilee, going to an area that was known as the region of the Gadarenes. And there were some individuals there, a couple of men who were possessed with multiple demons. Jesus cast out their demons. Now, these were guys who had terrorized this place, the whole area. Nobody could control them. They couldn't do anything with them. They were wild men, irrational, crazy. And now they've had these demons cast out, and the people see these men sitting with Jesus in their right minds. And the text says in Luke, the 8th chapter, verse 37, that they were seized with great fear. Wow. Why? Things are looking up. Seems to me we've eliminated a community problem here. They were afraid of Jesus. They didn't understand, apparently, the nature of his power. There may have been other reasons. I suspect they were afraid because they didn't understand about Jesus. And they asked him to leave, and he did. Have you ever noticed that when one is afraid, when we're afraid, that we are typically involved inside ourselves? We're all focused inward, looking inward with too much intensity. Some of you may have heard a story recently. There have been a number of incidents recently in which individuals came to schools with weapons and shot people. It happened at the University of Alabama at Huntsville. But it happened in a couple of other schools recently. But one story was interesting. Man came in, a student actually, came in to a school, and he started shooting, and he managed to wound some students, but he didn't do a lot of damage because there was a math teacher there, as I recall, who went and subdued this guy. And afterwards, they interviewed this guy, and basically what they were asking him was, "What were you thinking?" Guy was unarmed. And he went and subdued. He was thinking about the students. Those were his students. And he didn't want any more of them to get shot. And my point is, he wasn't thinking about himself or his own safety. He was thinking about the safety of others. And he was lauded, described as a hero and a very brave individual, and no doubt he is. But do you understand how he was able to do that? He wasn't focused on himself. What we need to do is lose ourselves in the service of Christ, and a lot of our fears will dissipate. We won't have time to focus on those things. And is it not the truth that many of the fears that we have are those which we ourselves invent? Things that do not ever happen, but that we are dreading as though they may happen? How many times as children did we convince ourselves that terrible things were waiting for us just around the corner? And our mind has grown these huge monsters who are ready to snatch us if we go around the corner in the dark. Mind can create all kinds of fears if you'll let it dwell on things. What we need to be doing also is we need to be encouraging one another. We say that word. Do we think about what that word means? If you encourage somebody else, what you are doing is you're trying to impart to them courage. If I encourage you to do good works, I'm trying to impart to you the courage, the bravery to do what you need to do in circumstances that may not be easy. And that's, of course, part of what we do in our assemblies, is it not? That we, according to Hebrews 10, verse 24, we consider one another. That word literally means to look intently on someone. You ever known somebody in the congregation that you knew was struggling with some difficulty? Maybe some temptation or some other kind of physical problem, and they're not sure they're going to make. Do you encourage them? You go to them and encourage them, exhort them to do the right thing? Well, that's what we ought to be doing for one another, according to Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24, and of course other passages. We began our study by looking at Joshua 1. In Joshua 1, Moses has died. And the Lord is now speaking to Joshua, and he's encouraging Joshua, you need to be strong and very courageous. But back in Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 38, God sent Moses to encourage Joshua. Now the Lord, I'm sure, knew that he was going to speak to Joshua and encourage him, but he sent Moses. Deuteronomy, of course, written just prior to the time of Joshua 1. Same location, geographically speaking. Same basic time period. Moses writes this farewell address. And in that address, God says to Moses, you go and encourage Joshua. I find it interesting that when Paul wrote the prison epistles, those four epistles that we refer to as the prison epistles, one of those is Philippians. And in Philippians 1, Paul makes the observation that despite the fact that he is in prison, he's in chains, the gospel is not chained. In fact, it has really turned out to be an opportunity for him to preach to some individuals apparently fairly high in Roman society. And he makes this observation, verse 14, that others had been emboldened to preach the gospel because of Paul's chains. And he notes that some of them were doing it out of the wrong motive, but others apparently had been encouraged by Paul's behavior and example. Encouraged to do what they needed to, or what they could do, what they needed to do. Well, I want to encourage you. Because you can't be a successful disciple of Jesus Christ if you don't have courage. You can't live with courage. Uncontrolled fear has the capacity to paralyze us. In Matthew, the 25th chapter, Jesus told a parable, a story, about some men who had been entrusted with goods. And the man who had entrusted them with these goods, he leaves the talents and he leaves. And he comes back and there's a reckoning. And you recall the first two, they've taken their goods and they've applied themselves and they've gained additional goods and they're rewarded, commended for that. But the last one, well, he had his talent. And he makes the observation when the master calls him to account for his stewardship. He makes the observation, I knew you were a hard man. And so I was afraid. What he did is he went and buried his talent. He didn't produce anything with it. He just did nothing. Well, someone says, yeah, he was responding to the master. The master says, you wicked and lazy servant. He didn't let him use fear as an excuse. He called him a lazy and wicked servant. Fear that's uncontrolled will paralyze us. It'll cause us not to do the things that we need to do. The Lord says that's the definition of laziness and wickedness. I've noticed that sometimes fear will cause us to strike out at others. Have you noticed that? That's even illustrated in the animal kingdom. You can have a dog who is the most gentle creature, never offers to growl at you or bite you or to harm any of your children. But if you'll push that dog hard enough, if you'll back him into a corner and make him think that he's going to be harmed, he will snarl and snap and bite you. Not because he suddenly became vicious and mean, but because he's afraid. And he will defend himself. You wonder why it is that Peter, in the Garden of Gethsemane, took a sword and lopped off somebody's ear and then ran like a coward with the rest of the disciples just a few moments later? Is it because suddenly all of his bravery evaporated? Or did he overreact because of his fear? Do you know how many times people persecute those who are different from them? Not because there's a threat, but because they are genuinely afraid of change or afraid of what these people might be. Fear that's uncontrolled really can harm us. And so what we need to do is adopt the same motto that David apparently did when he stood against Goliath. He lived by the truth of Hebrews 13:6. The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? When David stood before Goliath, he didn't stand before him as a foe equal in strength and skill and size. He said, you're an uncircumcised Philistine and the Lord is going to support me. He's going to help me. And that's exactly the way that he conquered his fear. I've often wondered, in that story, do you get the impression at any point that David is afraid? Not really. I don't. Do you think that there was some fear maybe in the back of his mind? You know, he's not a soldier. He's going out with stones and a sling. But he's confident. And I think the reason he's confident is because he knew who was his helper. And he trusted in God. One final story and then the lesson is yours. In 1 Samuel, the 28th chapter, there is the story of King Saul who had become unfaithful to God and God had basically removed his favor from Saul, had anointed David already as the next king. And Saul wishes to hear from the Lord how things are going to go in the impending battle with the Philistines. And so he goes and does what the law of God had forbidden, and that was he goes and he consults a witch. And she informs him, actually I should say Samuel informs him, that he's going to die. The next day, he's going to die. He's going to die in battle. And of course, that's exactly what happens. But when Saul hears that, he is so afraid that he falls down on the ground. He is absolutely paralyzed with fear. And I will tell you, I don't think it was because he was going to die. I think it was because he was totally unprepared to die. Because I read of another one of God's servants, the faithful Apostle Paul, who writes that he's ready to be offered, that the time of his departure is at hand. He's not groveling in fear at the prospect that he's going to be sacrificed for his faith, because he is totally prepared for death. And so I ask you the question. If the Lord came today, if He returned today and the world ends and judgment is here, Did you have cause to fear? Saul had every reason to be afraid. He needed to be afraid. And I don't know that he did anything about it. But fortunately, you have the opportunity. If you're not prepared, you have the opportunity this morning to do something about that. If you are guilty of sin, responsible before God and guilty of sin, then you need to accept the loving favor of God that He offers in the sacrifice of His Son. And allow the blood that was shed on the cross, as Tim spoke of in the preparation for the Lord's Supper, to cleanse you of your sins. We want to encourage you to obey the gospel as you see its commands, its precepts presented on the screen. We want to encourage you this morning to be courageous, to take the necessary step, and then live a life dependent on God, trusting in Him. If you need to obey the gospel, we stand to encourage you as we sing.